Hello and welcome to another episode of The Modern Enthusiast. I'm Doug.
I'm Adam.
And I'm James.
And last week you joined us when we talked about Jeskai Ascendancy. We talked about what made the deck work and whether it was ban-worthy or not. I think we had concluded that no, that this is a deck that the metagame can handle. This week we're definitely going to be talking about some answers to Jeskai Ascendancy. Last week, if you didn't catch the episode, we talked about how the deck plays out. So if you have not played against it before or seen how it works in Modern, you should definitely listen to our podcast from last week and check out the recommended resources we had from there. You'll be better prepared. We think a lot of the reason that people are still losing to this deck is that they do not know how it works and that they may not understand exactly how to fight it or just how fast or how slow it can be. We also have Adam back this week. He has recovered from his throat infection of some kind or another, so we are glad to have his dulcet tones joining the cast again. If you would like to get a hold of us, we are on Twitter. The handle there is Modern Podcast. You can also find all of our page information at mtgcast.com. We have our show notes there for each week, as well as our email address. When you write in, we listen, we respond, and we talk about what you write about on air. So if you have something you want us to discuss, please let us know. You can tweet to us also. And this week, by popular request, we had a lot of people feedback and say that they liked our Is It Good segment from a while back. So we have a whole list of cards to talk about this week about whether they're good or not in the current metagame. So we will be getting to that, but first we want to go over quickly some answers to the Jeskai Ascendancy combo. And they fight either by stopping the succession of cantrips or by stopping your early mana elves and combo spells. So James, why don't you let us know what you think you should be playing against Jeskai Ascendancy.
One of the cards I actually think is probably one of the highest cards on the list for me right now is Spirit of the Labyrinth. It's a card that actually slots pretty well into a pod deck anyway, mm-hmm. as it doesn't interrupt any of the pod combos.
And that is one mana and another white mana, 3/1. Players cannot draw extra cards, period, right?
Yeah.
So players can draw one card.
One card.
One card turn. So here's the deal from playing the Ascendancy deck last week. I played it in the tournament. It runs about 16 lands. If you shut off their mana dorks or constrain their ability to filter their mana, it is actually very hard for that deck to find a Glittering Wish and wish for an answer. So while Wear and Tear does answer most of the cards that you would play against the Ascendancy deck, if you stop the Ascendancy deck from getting going, it usually has problems finding Wear and Tear and the mana to cast the answer. And one of the things I really like about the Spirit of the Labyrinth is it stops that deck cold. They can't dig for any of their cards. None of their cards really do anything. The deck can't pressure you. It's a deck that is full of mana dorks and cantrips. If it can't cantrip, it can't do anything else. All it can do is generate mana. So it's a 3-1 clock. It turns off the Ascendancy deck cold, and it does not interfere with the combo deck of Pod at all, either Kiki Jiki or Malaira. It doesn't interfere with your combo at all.
You know, and fascinatingly also, you can run it in decks, even in decks that, like Splinter Twin, where you're running a couple cantrips, but for example, if you're running Dig Through Time, that does not draw cards. So you can get around that. If you're running Dark Confidant, for example, also, you can get the benefit of extra cards without ever actually drawing them.
It also slots into Green White Hate Bearers, Zoo decks. Fits well on the sideboard of a Zoo deck. It's a 3-1 creature, so that already fits what Zoo is trying to do on the combat side, while also completely hosing the deck. Let's see what's made of that deck. Other cards we had referenced, any of the Rule of Law effects, any of the you can only play one spell a turn, whether it be Ethersworn Canis or
Eidolon of Rhetoric or Rule of Law.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, stop the deck pretty well. They can only play one spell a turn. It gives you at least two turns before they can draw an answer. As I said, Wear Tear costs 3 mana, and they have to Glittering Wish for it, so you're looking at a 4-5 mana investment. That's usually going to take them 2 turns to get to.
Hopefully. Well, Wear and Tear costs 1 mana. 2 mana.
White Half is 2.
The White Half is 1. And
White Half White Half is 1, Red Half is 2. Yeah. My mistake, guys, is the backwards. Yeah, it's right, it's a race and shatter.
I'm going to pay attention next time you cast that card against me to make sure you're playing it honestly. Oh, yeah, I mean, certainly they have to work hard to get around those. Another thing that had come up was Eidolon of Great Rebel. It is the red 2/2. Whenever a player casts a spell, it deals 3 damage. So that shuts them down cold. Even if you're glittering wishing for an answer, that's still 6 damage that you take. And that is oppressive. You know, you had mentioned killing the mana dorks. Every deck has access to Gutshot if they really want it.
That's good. The pyroclasm effects are also, like, pretty devastating.
Especially if you're playing Affinity. You can play Whip Flare, which is a card that's commonly found in Affinity sideboards. Mm-hmm. I mean, we had this conversation last week when before I played the deck. Someone told me that they thought they had to board 7 cards against it, and they didn't want to play it. They had to put that many cards in their sideboard. And I went through his particular sideboard and peeled off, I think, 8 cards that would have been pretty good against the Ascendancy combo that he was already playing.
Mm-hmm.
And he told me he thought Ascendancy was still better, and I rattled off a quick 3-1 with him playing his Affinity deck against the Ascendancy deck, because if you kill the Mana Dorks, the deck can't go off. And so you can disrupt them and clock them pretty easily, actually. They don't have any ways of protecting their creatures. The sideboard only has about 8 cards in it, because the rest are wish targets.
Yeah, you know, even an early spell Pierce against them, even if they can pay for it, can still slow that deck quite a bit down.
Yeah. Any Wrath effects, if you live that long, will stop the combo pretty hard.
The other important thing with combo decks also is putting them on a clock. Mm-hmm. I think we talked about that probably a while ago about how to fight against some of the other popular combo decks in the format, and it's true of combo decks in any format, is one of the most important things is you have to present them with a clock that forces them to do something in the next, 2 to 5 turns, basically, so that they don't have an infinite amount of time to sculpt a hand so that you can't actually win. So, also, it's very important in the decks where you want to play all these hate spells, mm-hmm. that you don't keep a hand that's got, 2 counter spells, 1 hate spell, and a bunch of lands, and you're not actually doing
anything. Yeah, that's why I like cards like the Eidolons and Canonist, and we talked about Talia, Guardian of Freedom earlier. I like those. Vendilion Click is a fine card on its own. Inquisition of Kozilek followed by Dark Confidant is a very good way to start off against that kind of deck.
Yeah, the discard spells are probably pretty hard, bless you.
Now, like,
most combo decks, discard.
Yeah, I think this is super greedy, but we did talk about Deflecting Palm. James brought it up that when they are ready to kill you with a giant dude, or they are going to be wishing for the fling to kill you, that you can, if you can hold Deflecting Palm all that time, you can conceivably kill them with their own creature.
Does the modern version not play Swan Song?
Well, so they didn't have 4 Swan Songs on the sideboard, but it doesn't have many cards to slide out, and it doesn't have many cards to slide in. So if you are, say, blue-white-red Geist or blue-white-red Control, my guess is they're far more likely to board in the white Leyline against you than they are Swan Song.
Mm-hmm.
And they can only board in so many cards that needs to keep a minimum number of cantrips. And so, like, if they have their Swan Songs, they kind of have to see it and think about it and know that's what you're holding up.
Mm-hmm. And I also think Chalice of the Void at 1 is quite good against that deck because they depend on all the cantrips to get through. You know, you certainly have to make sacrifices on your own. It means that you probably board out Lightning Bolts and Serum Visions if you run those. But if I'm playing against the Ascendancy combination deck, I'd probably find cutting Lightning Bolts at the very least. You probably keep Serum Visions for the games that you don't draw your Chalice. But we shouldn't preclude running Chalice, especially when it is very good against other decks like Burn.
Mm-hmm.
You know, especially if you're playing a deck like Blue-White-Red Control where they're not predicting you to play artifacts, then they won't be bringing in Smash to Smithereens, and their Burn spells get a lot less useful.
You should also be aware of cards that you're already playing in your deck that are very good against the Ascendancy deck.
Abrupt Decay
is
blowing
very
up the Ascendancy
good.
Itself.
But, like, Linvala, which is a card that you will find in almost every pod list, is practically game over for the Ascendancy. It takes them...
Do you think that you can live that long against that deck, though, to get a Linvala out?
I got Kiki potted on turn 3 with a Linvala, and that was pretty strong.
Wow, that is...
He went turn 2 pod, played a 2-drop, potted a 2-drop for...
Exarch.
An Exarch, untapped it and potted his Exarch into Linvala, and that was just ballgame.
That was it.
Huh. Yeah, I was like, oh, I was going to combo you next turn, but now I'm on 2 lands, 3 mana dorks, and I will never undo it again. So, I mean, it depends, but if you're playing something like Junk and you have discard removal, I suspect you should be able to live to your turn 4. If you're playing Pod, you also have access to Orzhov Pontiff, going Pod Pontiff into 2-drop into Pontiff, kill your guys, Pod Pontiff into you know, Linvala when you're rebuilding is probably
game over. And the advantage of Linvala and Pontiff and Talia is that all three of them get around Swansong. Whereas even Eidolon of Great Revel will get countered by Swansong because it is also an enchantment.
The other thing I think that's important to note about all these cards, I guess, with the exception of Talia, who sees a little bit of fringe play in Modern, but not too much, is that all these cards are in decks and sideboards already, for
yes.
the most part. Like, these are not cards that are, like, you're going to have to jam them only for Jeskai Ascendancy. Mm-hmm. Like, these are cards that you probably have in a lot of your sideboards already, or if you're not running them, they're at least very reasonable to have because they're not only good. Like, Whip Flare are only good against the Ascendancy deck. Like, Whip Flare out of Affinity sideboard is not only good against the Ascendancy deck. It's good against Pod and other decks mm-hmm. that are trying to gum up the ground. So
yeah, and I think if you run Dismember, you should absolutely be boarding in against the Ascendancy deck, and you should be killing their turn one elf if you can.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people want their Dismembers to hit Restoration Angels and Kiki Jiki and Tarmogoyf, and sometimes you're really just fine killing a Noble Hierarch.
That is the other thing to watch out for. Until people start boarding in, like, large threats in their sideboard, that deck can't kill you any other way than comboing. And while I've seen a lot of people talk about, you know, putting in this card or that card as a Glittering Wish target as an alternative win condition, I haven't seen one actually in a list
mm-hmm.
with people playing with it. So, I mean, I would be okay with fetching down to a low life total and being aggressive with my life sources, because they're probably not going to kill you with Noble Hierarchs.
Mm-hmm. So we've talked about Leyline of Ascendancy, or Jeskai Ascendancy quite a bit. If you have answers that we haven't thought of, or you have different strategies against the deck, definitely let us know. But we are going to dive right into our Is It Good segment, and this is starting off with a card that does appear on the Jeskai Ascendancy sideboard, Leyline of Sanctity. Is it good right now, Adam?
I would say yes. I have played it in my sideboard of various, you know, white X decks
mm-hmm.
before. I don't know if it's the best thing you can play, but it certainly has a lot of utility.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty good against all the black decks with discard spells. On a side note, the 8-rack deck could never be the Leyline of Sanctity.
Yeah.
It's good, really good against Burn. And it's got some utility against a deck like Scapeshift, where mm-hmm. It doesn't end the game because Scapeshift has ways of getting rid of it, but it's sort of another thing, it's another speed bump for them before they can actually kill you. And in a matchup like a blue-white-red mirror, not being able to burn your opponent is pretty relevant.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's a pretty solid card.
James, would you run less than 4?
I've run 3 of that card before. I'm not really a great numbers guy, so I haven't actually, like, looked at what your odds are about getting a 3 when you're opening hands to a 4, but I've run 3 before, especially in decks that can cast it, or where I'm not expecting to be that big in the metagame. But I'm a huge fan of that card right now. There's been a huge uptick in burn since Grand Prix Worcester, and then the Japanese Grand Prix won thereafter.
Yeah, GP Kobe was won by a burn deck.
Yeah, there's been a huge uptick in burn, especially in our area. It's very, very good against the junk decks that were very popular prior to the Ascendancy. I think the Ascendancy combo deck might take some of the wind out of the junk deck sales, but it's very good against the junk decks. It's very good against the burn deck. It is pretty good against decks like Scapeshift and Ad Nauseam. I mean, those decks are clearly designed to have an answer to that card in mind in their sideboard, because they know people are going to bring in cards like that to stop them, so it doesn't, like, it's not the end-all be-all answer, but it will slow them down quite a bit. It's very good in the sideboard of the Ascendancy deck. It's a 4 of in most of the lists. So I think that card is very good. I've played 3 of it on occasion. I like playing 3 of it a lot more if you're playing it in a deck that can cast it.
Mm-hmm.
If you're trying to run it in a deck that can't cast it or has trouble casting it, I think having 4 and trying to maximize the number of times you can put it into play for free is important.
I've liked running 3 of it a lot also in a deck where you're not leaning on that being like your only card in a lot of specific matchups, where when you have it, it's awesome and you have the capability of casting it when you draw one, but it's not like the centerpiece of your hate mm-hmm. In the given matchups where you want it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when I played Boggles, and it was an automatic 4-up because that deck can't ever cast it, and there are matches where it must have that card to in order to win, so there were entire games where I, you know, like had to lead in the ball, get into it, and so mm-hmm. I think that card is a 4-up in a lot of decks, but in a lot more fair decks, as Adam said, where you're just not leaning on it as your only source of hate or protection, it's a very 3-up.
So I think that Leyline is a pretty fine card. I just don't tend to have room on my sideboards for it. I think it's one of those cards that's quite good against a lot of stuff, but doesn't really have the focus that I look for to fix a specific problem.
That's sort of where I've been with the card recently, is that I like it, and if I ever had sideboard slot, like extra sideboard slots,
yeah.
I would love running them.
Like, every deck has probably 8 to 12 cards that get stopped by Leyline of Sanctity. Like, even Gifts Ungiven will be stopped by a Leyline of Sanctity because of targets. So there are good reasons to run it, but I always feel like it's probably the 5th or 6th card I want to sideboard in sometimes, so... Let's go down the list. This is one that presages what James will be playing tomorrow to show off and play something for our fans in Mardu Zoo. It is Doran the Siege Tower.
I always want this card to be good. I mean, it's a 5/5 for 3, and I grew up with Phyrexian Negator being a very potent tournament staple card, and Negator was a 5/5 for 3 with several glaring drawbacks.
Mm-hmm.
And as big of a fan as I am of 5/5 for 3s, I don't like Doran that much. He's slow. He often encourages people to play terrible cards in their deck, because most people who play Doran decks will play a lot of creatures with huge toughnesses that aren't necessarily good on their own, and I think he kind of leads you to do that. Treefolk Harbinger being the obvious one. People play Treefolk Harbinger, the card does nothing without a Doran to play. So, I am not a huge fan of Doran in the format. I will be playing it tomorrow on the Mardu Zoo, which, if people are unfamiliar, it's the combination of Doran and the Siege Tower and Mardu Ascendancy to be a pseudo-overrun. Mardu Ascendancy sacks all your creatures +0/+3. Doran makes creatures do damage equal to their toughness instead of power. So, you attack, it triggers Ascendancy for your guys, and as long as you attack with Doran and one other creature, it's actually lethal if unblocked, because it makes 2/1/1 tokens and your other creature. The 2/1/1 tokens and your first creature will add up to about 12 power, and Doran will be the additional 8. And so it's a, you know, little cute 2-card combo, but I think Doran is probably poorly positioned right now. He's slow, he's clunky, he makes you very vulnerable to Blood Moon. He doesn't match up really well against other big threats in the format. Specifically, he's not great against Scavenging Ooze, which is a card that gets much bigger very quickly, and usually will end up outclassing Doran, and he dies to lots of removal.
I think his biggest problem is that he is Tarmogoyf, but for 3 mana in 3 colors.
Uh-huh.
Like, he's fine, but I feel like there's not a lot of modern decks where he is optimal. Like, you play your Doran, and your opponent has a Tarmogoyf in play, and your Tarmogoyf is now a 5/5 instead of a 4/5, and they just trade, and you've lost. You're losing tempo because your 3-drop is trading with a 2-drop that you should probably just be playing anyway. Mm-hmm. And I kind of agree. He kind of makes you want to play some other cards that are not only really good with him, but I feel like it's a card that everyone has always wanted to be good and has just never quite gotten to that level. That being said, there was one that I think we made the finals of the of Modern Champs at Gen Con this year.
There was.
But there were a lot of cards in there that I'm not sure really belong in the format. So
Doran seems to have some strange unintended consequences as well against certain matchups. The pod decks in particular. If you have turn 3 Doran ready to go, but your opponent has a Wall of Roots on turn 2 and they know you are playing Doran, that Wall of Roots beats just about every creature you play if they never roll it down. Like, you're giving them a 5/5 blocker, right? If you're playing against, like, these Blade Splicer decks with Restoration Angel, they have Wall of Omens, so now they have a 4/4 blocker. And that stuff can, I think, it can come right back at you.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's always a problem. It makes Tarmogoyfs trade with one another instead of bounce off one another.
It makes the Seabrax Arc a 4/4 flash creature, by the way.
Yeah, I mean, It's interesting. It does turn all of your other one drops into wild account on the zoo list, which I think is kind of interesting, because Kurt Ape and Lone Lion become 3/3s. But I think, by and large, the most interesting thing about Doran is, I don't know if there's ever been a card in Magic history to have such a pedigree. I mean, Doran was a tournament staple card in Standard, in Extended, in Shorter Extended, everywhere it could be, except for Modern. It has just never been able to crack into the stratosphere of Modern. I think that's kind of interesting, but I also think that's, you know, very telling. Mm-hmm. If they've got a card that's dominant everywhere it's ever been, and in the 3 years of Modern, it's never once really cracked up in a lot of top eights, it's probably not a card that's worth experimenting with.
Mm-hmm. So, I think we're all pretty lukewarm on Doran. Another one that goes along sort of in that era is Sakura Tribe Elder. Obviously, it sees plays in Scapeshift. I think I try it now and then in other decks where you're looking to, for example, play Cryptic Command and Eternal Witness. But I think for the most part, Sakura Tribe Elder is just not better than Wall of Roots in any other deck.
I think that your regular, in a lot of matchups, just your regular one-drop mana dorks, like your Hierarchs and your Birds, are probably better than Tribe Elder. Like, mm-hmm. obviously the reason Tribe Elder is really good in Scapeshift is you want the actual land, not just the mana. But I think that's the only realm in which Sakura Tribe Elder is just better than your actual creature mana dorks, like Hierarch Birds, Wall of Roots. I think the only instance getting a land out of your deck is what's more important. And the only deck that's actually important in Modern right now is Scapeshift. So that's the only place I would play it. I don't think I'd play it anywhere else.
So moving from a 2-drop that's lackluster, what about Young Pyromancer?
Young Pyromancer is awesome. He is worse in Modern than he is in Legacy because Modern decks on the whole play more removal spells than Legacy decks do, and also there's a little bit more creatures. But he is awesome. He combines extremely well with Swift Spear, extremely well with Snapcaster Mage. He combines fairly well with Treasure Cruise decks that want to fill up your graveyard to cast a matchup with Treasure Cruise. I expect a huge uptick in the number of decks you see that are jamming Young Pyromancer. I think that guy is one of the best creatures they've ever printed in. I think he'll get better in every set because they'll keep printing more and more instants.
Yeah, we were talking about this a little bit before the cast, this cycle of really good 2-drops, and there's one in each color that we could name from the last, 6 or 8 years, that are one mana of that color's color and then one colorless. And Young Pyromancer was the red one of that, along with Tarmogoyf Dark Confidant, Stoneforge Mystic, and Snapcaster Mage, and he's certainly on the power level of all of those cards. So he is basically, in Legacy, he is his own archetype. And in Modern, he's also pretty much the centerpiece of the blue-red, aggressive flashback graveyard decks. Like, it's him and Snapcaster Mage, and then spells, and sometimes you play Delver or Swift Spear now. But yeah, the card is very good. He gives you unbelievable amounts of value for playing cards that are already good on their own. And he's both good aggressively and defensively.
I seem to never have them live, which is my problem. I play them on turn two, and then they immediately die. And I suppose if you hold it till turn five, you get a whole lot of elemental tokens, even if they try and kill it, but I don't know that that's how I should be playing the card. Maybe I need to play it in a deck that presents a lot of other early threats where you play a turn one Monastery Swift Spear. Maybe that's what eats the lightning bolt. I know one day I will actually have it live until I can get elemental tokens, but today's not the day.
The only time I've ever actually cast that card was in, Limited. But, certainly killed my fair share and been killed by my fair share of them. So
I played Blue-Red Delver for quite a while on Magic Online, and I will likely play it again as soon as I figure out the new list I want to play. I haven't quite figured out if Treasure Cruise or Snapcaster Mage is the right card that I want to go with that deck, but it's extremely good in decks like that. And, like, what tends to happen is, like, if you ever go to a late game where you pull off the top, you're like, well, now every spell I have is two spells. And he looks fragile, and he definitely is fragile, but he can take a game over by himself. He creates an army. He makes all of your good spells better. He's just a heck of a magic card. I'm very high on him at the moment. And I'm especially high on him because I believe that in the coming weeks, with Treasure Cruise, with Dig Through Time, with Swiss Spear, that you are more likely to see a resurgence in both blue-red bird decks of kind of a Delver variety and in blue and red decks playing him. I mean, I think you're just going to see a lot more decks in general playing him and trying to leverage the advantage of very powerful cards from the new set, like Swiss Spear, like Treasure Cruise, like Dig Through Time.
So, we also have another spot here. It is in that interchangeable 5-drop spot, occupied by cards like Keranos, Sarkhan, Thundermaw, Hellkite, Baneslayer Angel. This one is Storm Breath Dragon.
For whatever reason, Jeff Hoogland used to be really fond of playing this card at his stream in Modern. I think this card sucks in Modern. I can't imagine a time where I want this card and not Stormbreath Dragon, or not Thundermaw Hellkite, except for a point in which my opponent has Lingering Souls tokens in play, and I know they have Path to Exile in hand, and I know that but can't do anything about it. It's just like, 4 is not that big. I think you're going to have problems raising Tarmogoyfs with a 4-4 dragon, and it can't block them. Protection from white makes it only relevant for maybe one and a half removal spells. It stops a Path to Exile, and it stops a Lightning Helix, but there's just, like, not the most commonly played. Yes, it can't be Abrupt Decayed, but the worst part is it looks really bad when it matches up with another 5-drop Trump. It loses the race, at least on the front half, to a Batterskull. It loses the race to the 5-5 dragon.
Well, you can Monstrous that guy.
And you can equip a Batterskull to another creature.
Suppose so.
And then, like, I'm not even sure, so it Monstrous to a 7-7. I don't even think so. They swing, you swing 7, they swing 4. You're getting in for 3, and they're getting in for 4. I think you still lose that race, because they gain 4 life every turn. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's an interesting card, and it's certainly one to think about, but I think it's just third or fourth in the row.
You can find situations, I think, where it's better than some of the other big trumps, but I think, by and large, the other ones are better. Like, I've played Baneslayer Angel and Gideon before also, and I think I would play in decks where you could cast all of these spells, and they're pretty much all blue, white, and red cards for the most part, or artifacts. I think that most of those are probably better than Stormbreath. You can make situations where Stormbreath is better than a card like Thundermaw Hellkite, but especially in that specific comparison, I think Thundermaw is just better. Like, it hitting for 5 and being able to mess with your opponent's board at the same time is, I think, a huge game.
Not only is Thundermaw Hellkite awesome, I'll bet you that Thundermaw Hellkite is probably $6 or less right now, and the dragon is still $20.
I think Thundermaw Hellkite is still expensive.
Is it really?
Yeah, I believe it's still at least 10 or 12. While James is looking that up, I wanted to talk about Elspeth Knight Errant. This is the original Elspeth, so she'll make a dude, she'll jump a guy and give it +3/+3, or she has a pretty irrelevant ultimate whereby all your permanents become indestructible.
I've always liked this card a lot, and I think conventional wisdom dictated for a very long time that Elspeth was the second best planeswalker they've ever printed behind Jace the Mind Sculptor. And she certainly saw plenty of play in Standard and some of the old extended formats, and saw a lot of play in Legacy after Jace got big, because she was like the Jace killer.
Yeah.
My biggest problem with the card is not that I think it's bad, it's that no one has been playing it at all, and it doesn't feel like there's a great home for it. It grinds pretty hard, it ticks up to 5 counters the first turn it's in play, and it puts a guy in front. So I don't think it's just bad, but it's also a 4-mana sorcery, and tapping out on a turn where, and a lot of times you don't want to tap out on that turn, regardless of, you know, kind of what you're playing. And I want to play it, I want it to be good, but I feel it's just not stellar at the moment. I don't think it can be bad. like just outright bad because it's a very powerful card.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not exactly what I want to be doing on my turn four, or it's not exactly the card I want to be paying four mana on one of my main phases for at the moment.
It reminds me of Sword of Fire and Ice. We know that that card is good. It has been good in the past. It will continue to be good, even in Modern, especially in Modern, but there's not a great home for it. And I think the place where you're playing creatures that are quality enough that you want to jump them with Elspeth, or that you want to put a sword on them, you know, you're spending 4 or 5 mana sorcery speed to make a what is either a very fragile token, with the goal of getting a better result, or playing an artifact and equipping it to something with the hope that your opponent doesn't kill it in response.
Mm-hmm.
I like Elspeth. I don't think she's become bad, but like you, I don't think that there's a great spot for her. I mean, the Malira decks have decided that they do not want to be a post-board Elspeth deck. The junk decks don't do that either.
It would be the last 4-drop Planeswalker I think I would reach for in those colors. Second list. I like the new Sorin better than that Elspeth in Modern. I think the +1/+0 on the new Sorin is actually really handy if you're playing Lingering Souls, if you're playing Tarmogoyfs. So, mostly the decks I think you would play Elspeth in are junk decks, blue-white-red control and Geist decks. There isn't really a whole lot of other homes. And those decks in junk, I prefer 4-mana Garruk. He makes bigger creatures that are bigger impact on the board, and allows you to hold up removal spells on your opponent more easily. I like the new Sorin. I think life gain is remarkably more important. There's going to be a lot of burn decks in the future, both blue-red with a Delver base and Treasure Cruise and the traditional red-white, everything does 40 that we've been seeing lately. I really like the Ajani Vengeance index. He's proven to be a lot better in Modern than I ever would have anticipated, and he fits that same slot. So it's not that I don't think Elspeth is a good card. I just think she's lower impact and too slow compared to the other options, or just doesn't fit the deck as well. You could play her very easily in the standard junk deck in the slot. They usually play one Groot Wildspeaker. But Groot Wildspeaker makes a bigger token to stabilize the board. And if you don't need to make a bigger token, you can play him and untap and either flashback Lingering Souls for 2 mana or hold up any of a variety of removal spells, most notably Abrupt Decay. And that lets you play kind of offense and defense better than tap out for this card and make a 1/1.
Mm-hmm.
If you were guaranteed to only be playing against other grindy decks and that every round was just going to be a grind fest, I think you can make a good case for Elspeth there. But when you're playing against decks that have, Lingering Souls, or you're playing against Blue-Red Delver and, mm-hmm. Blue-Red Twin and stuff, those decks just don't care about Elspeth.
Yeah. So, if I were going to rank her, though, even in the grindy mirrors on a list of Planeswalkers, I would have her in front of Sorin, Lord of Innistrad, but behind Sorin, Solemn Law Visitor, Grook, Wildspeaker, she's probably worse than a Ajani Vengeance as far as Modern goes, because the threat of Blink, because Vengeance can't attack other Planeswalkers, mm-hmm. the threat of Blinker lands. It's a very powerful card, but I feel that it's a very low impact card. Even in grindy matchups, it takes probably a good 2 to 4 turns to really get going and generate an advantage, mm-hmm. and a lot of the other Planeswalkers just generate an advantage much faster. It's not a bad card. If those other cards didn't exist, I think she'd play, but I like 2 Garruks, a Sorin, and a Ajani better than I like her right now.
So, a more current one, I know we talked about it before, Murderous Cut, we can be brief on this one. I think it's fine as a 1 or a 2 of, I don't think you run 4 because there's just better early removal if you need it. And then later on, I think it gets very good when you're trying to hold up Cryptic Command.
I've been playing it in standard, in a self-mill, a bug self-mill deck, and it's been unbelievably good in standard.
Uh-huh.
But standard is also a format right now that is defined by 3 and 4 mana removal spells, and modern is a format defined by 1 and 2 mana removal spells.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a fine card to play in modern. I don't think it's bad, because I think the card itself is very good.
Uh-huh.
But you need a real good reason to want to be casting that card instead of Lightning Bolt, Path to Exile, Dismember, and various other removal spells that are ubiquitous in the format already.
Prior to Jeskai Ascendancy combo deck really kind of popping up, I would have said that I would cut every Dismember I was playing for a Murderous Cut. Because I think realistically nobody really wants to pay retail, or no one really wants to pay for life to really cast those members. You do occasionally, but you try your hardest not to. And I think that card's better when you're just like wanting to hold up a one mana removal spell in the mid game. And I think Murderous Cut does that better. I also like it better in slots where people would play Slaughter Pact. But now that the Ascendancy deck is a thing and you really want your removal right away on turn one, on turn three, you know, you don't have time to wait or fill up your yard, I'm not sure where that leaves Murderous Cut. So I think I'm with Doug right now. I think Murderous Cut is a one, max two of. But if the format changes back, they ban the Ascendancy, if the Ascendancy deck isn't good, like Doug and I actually think it is, like Doug and I both think the deck's probably not that great, if one of those two things happens, I think Murderous Cut stock goes way up. If you go to a tournament and everyone's playing Ascendancy, I think you really want Dismembers, Ulcerates, Disfigures. And so it's going to be, I think that the fate of that card is really going to be hanging in the balance with the way the format swings. If we're swinging to you really need your removal spell on turn three, it will not be very good. Mm-hmm. And if we swing towards games going turns four, five, six, it'll be incredible and you might want up to four to complement out your removal spells in your postboard.
Now here's another Delve card that we have not talked about before. I think this will round out all of the Delve cards printed, but this is a piece of tech that James and I were speaking about before. It is the card Become Immense. It costs 5 colorless and 1 green. It's an instant with Delve, and it says target creature gets +6/+6 until end of turn. Become Immense, we have been surprised by, because +6/+6 is huge. I foresee playing this as the Miser's one-of sort of spell. I think of in a deck like Rug Twins, so let me give you an example why. For 1 mana, you have protection from Dismember with it. So you can avoid that. You can use it in a pinch to get past things like a blocking Tarmogoyf. You can make any chump block into an amazing block. And it also cashes out 6 damage for a green mana, so you can close in on an opponent much, much faster than they would think. We have talked about Become Immense also as a 1 or 2 of in an Infect deck with the potential to just totally kill somebody really quickly. I don't think it'll jump beyond that, but I do like the thought of running it, and it is much more compelling than Giant Growth. Like, you never run Giant Growth in Modern. That's a silly card to run. But the difference between 6 and 3 is huge.
There are times in the Dark Ages of Magic where Might of Oaks has been a card, the 4 mana +7/+7.
Mm-hmm.
And this is 6/7 of a Might of Okrozo, but for 1 mana.
Might of Oaks.
Or Might of Oaks, sorry, yeah. The 4/4, yeah. 6/7 of a Might of Oaks for 1 mana. If Zoo were a thing, I kind of really like this. Is like a 2 of in a Zoo deck. It gets you 1 more mana than the, you know, traditional Might of Alara, which I think is the guys might reprint, gets you. But you can do it in a Naya Zoo deck or a Dark Zoo deck. You don't have to play 5 colors.
Mm-hmm.
I actually do like it as a 2 of in an Infect deck where if everything has gone totally wrong and they have decimated your board, it's something that you can rip to make any one creature probably kill your opponent. I'm not sure how many you want to play, but I played the Become Immense Dragon Styles Twin combo deck in Standard as a joke at an FNM, and was surprised how many people just died when things suddenly became immense. And that's where I started thinking that, like, you know, Become Immense probably has more playability in Magic and in Modern than you think. It's also the best phallic-named card since Batterskull. So for those juveniles in here, we start talking about things becoming immense and Adam just burst out laughing, currently giggling that none of them would see us.
Adam's trying to not laugh on tape right now, and he's having a very hard time.
Becoming Immense.
I cast it twice in Two-Headed Giant Sealed for 6. It was good.
Yeah,
it's not a card I would ever cast. It seems fine as a 1 or 2 of in Infect for that same kind of situation where, you know, you cast some stuff, maybe your opponent removed one of your guys, and it pretty much instantly makes something lethal.
Yeah.
It's kind of interesting in the Zoo deck. I didn't think about it there. But in Zoo, you're definitely filling up your yard because your opponent's bolting your Nacatls and you're bolting your opponent's face, and all of a sudden
you fish very aggressively.
Yeah, you make a 10-10 Tarmogoyf and you kill your opponent. Mm-hmm. So it seems pretty reasonable.
It's rough to think of in a junk deck because those are running Dark Confidant, and I don't think taking 6 life to become immense is worth playing that card. Not the payoff of taking 4 life to draw Jace the Mind Sculptor, for example.
But 6 is a huge portion of your life, especially when it's being put onto a 2-2, 3-3, 4-5, yeah. Whatever it is.
And it means that if your opponent goes, for example, Karn, and you have a Mana Elf, you can kill the Karn right then and there. It'll kill just about every Planeswalker that sees play. Mm-hmm. So here's another card, Blade Splicer. We've been seeing it in the Team Geist decks that run Restoration Angel and Blade Splicer. Personally, I don't like Blade Splicer a whole lot. I understand why people run it with the idea that you get a really great benefit when you hit it with Restoration Angel, but I think 4 mana, most of it first striking for 3 damage, is not very good in Modern. Especially because it dies to Lightning Bolt, obviously, and then you're stuck with a 1-1. Or they remove the 1-1, and then you have a 3-3 Golem that does not have First Strike anymore and cannot withstand anything. I mean, it'll trade with the Kitchen Finks, and that's about it.
This card falls into my, it's fine category, but not the best thing that you can play for 3. In the vein with the Lightning Bolt thing, your opponent has to make a decision when that card's in play about whether or not they want to bolt the token and leave you with the 1-1, or bolt the 1-1 and leave you with a 3-3, because in a deck where you play Blade Splicer, you are assuredly playing 4 Restoration Angels, or you're probably doing it wrong, and you have to make a decision. Do they have the angel in hand, or can I beat the other 3-3 and the 1-1 and the 3-4 if they draw the angel? I think it's a fine card, but I don't think it's the thing that I want to cast for 3 mana right now. If I'm paying 3 mana for a sorcery, the things that I want to be tapping out for 3 in this format are Lingering Souls, Liliana of the Veil, stuff like that. And I feel like those cards are much higher impact. Now, Blaze Pleasure doesn't match up too badly against Liliana of the Veil, but I think against Lingering Souls, it doesn't match up too well.
You mentioned it pretty well against Lingering Souls. Because you have the same amount of power, and it eats all the souls. The souls that can't only block it, one at a time. But I like Blade Splicer. If I lived in a place where everyone played Affinity, and every deck had 4 of the, what's the guy's program, all colors?
Etched Champions.
4 Etched Champions. I would want to see a lot of Blade Splicers. If I lived in a world of lots of Zoo decks, I would like to see a lot of Blade Splicers. Cincinnati, at least our metagame, doesn't really favor either of those decks a ton. We have kind of a fairly well-rounded metagame, but a lot of blue decks. I don't like Blade Splicer against a lot of the blue decks. He's not good against Delver. Having your token unsummoned feels very awful, like losing one life and then having a 1-1 for 3 mana is kind of unpleasant. So I think that this card is very metagame dependent. I think it's very underwhelming. I think it's a very average power level for a Modern card. If you were to kind of chart a curve of where you want your cards to be, I believe you would want most of your cards to be on the other side of the curve from Blade Splicer, but I think Blade Splicer is probably a little, south of the middle on a power levels curve.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a fine Magic card. It's not embarrassing if you're playing it. There are certainly entire metagames that you can easily see where you would want it. But if you live in a Pod, Twin, Delver, Control, Jund metagame, which is where we live, I don't want it. And if you're playing on Moto with a lot of Burn, a lot of Delver, and then some of the other, more expensive decks, I still don't really want it.
I mean, I think about, what's the best case scenario? Okay, you have Blade Splicer, you Restoration Angel it. Now you have 2 Blade Splicer tokens, Golems. And that's what you're bragging about? Like, if you have Kitchen Finks and you Restoration Angel it, you have blocked at least 3 times, you gained 4 life, and you have probably a better board position than you did when you had Blade Splicer. I would rather be affecting combat with blocking and gaining life, or, for example, you can Restoration Angel other cards that flat out win you the game. You can Restoration Angel a Wall of Omens and draw a card. I just think, like, the greatest possible payoff on this is, like, somebody attacks with their Tarmogoyf, you Restoration Angel your Blade Splicer, now you have 6 power worth of First Striking Golems. That's, like, the best-case scenario. And that sounds like standard level power to me. That doesn't sound like modern level.
Interestingly enough, I was playing Blue-Eyed Red Control in a modern 8-man last night on Mono, and I played against a guy playing Blade Splicer. I think he was, like a green-white guy's deck.
Uh-huh.
And, he thought he had me on a couple different occasions with a Blade Splicer and the Golem token, uh-huh. and I went Snapcaster, Electrolyze, one to the Blade Splicer, one to the Golem, draw card, block, and it felt terrible for him. Like, mm-hmm.
I want to be on the side of that where I'm Snapcastering, not where I'm Blade Splicing for a Snapcaster Mage.
Yeah, I mean, there are certainly metagames where that card is better, but overall, I think the card is not on the power level where you normally want to be playing.
I think we have agreed that we're not going to be summoning that guy anytime soon. I have Gifts Ungiven on my list. Adam and I both love this card. I think we can be brief. Gifts is not good right now, and Elesh Norn isn't good right now because the decks that it would stop aren't stopped by it anymore.
Love Gifts, can't cast it, doesn't do anything.
Yeah, you spend 4 mana, then you end up getting a whole bunch of removal spells, and now you've cast 7 mana for 2 removal spells. And it's not stellar.
And then you die.
And then you die, yeah, because then you die.
If it's at all possible, I actually think Gifts is probably going to be slightly worse, because I think there's going to be an uptick in counter spells to fight the new draw 2 and draw 7s in Dig Through Time and Treasure Cruise. And if there's an uptick in counter magic to fight big splashy game winning spells, it certainly fights that one as well.
Yeah, this is where I make my weekly appeal to Wizards to print Red Elemental Blast, because Guttural Response doesn't do quite enough for me.
I didn't know Guttural Response was a card until last week when I needed one for my sideboard to play Ascendancy.
Guttural. Okay, Threads of Disloyalty. Threads classically has had good Pro Tour play. Sean McLaren used it to steal a Tarmogoyf or a Scavenging Ooze to win a Pro Tour. He said that Threads was the best card in his deck. He was running it as a one-of, and he was so glad to have it. Threads, I think, is very good against the decks that run Dark Confidant, Scavenging Ooze, Tarmogoyf, because they're going to be ending up likely 2-for-1-ing themselves to be able to get rid of the threat that they just gave you. But I think it's pretty bad against Pod, because all you're taking is a Voice of Resurgence, which could be significant, or a Scavenging Ooze. And I wouldn't be taking a Mana Elf, I wouldn't be taking a Wall of Roots, and there's really no other targets in those decks that you see before they start comboing.
I own a couple of them. Pretty expensive card, I think.
It's at least $20, yeah.
I've played it as a one-of in blue-white-red sideboards and other blue deck sideboards.
Mm-hmm.
It has frequently been good when I have drawn it, mm-hmm. and I haven't missed it when I haven't had it. I also played a couple of them in the sideboard of Fairies when I was playing Fairies.
Uh-huh.
And I think Fairies is bad, but it was good in... It was a pretty good sideboard in that deck because it answers Tarmogoyf in a deck that... doesn't have very many ways of dealing with a resolve,
mm-hmm.
Tarmogoyf. I think it's a fine card. It's a utility card, so, you know, it can be a couple different things. It's annoying for your opponent to get their Tarmogoyf stolen.
Mm-hmm. If they can abrupt decay to get it back, it's still quite a hassle.
Mm-hmm. It falls into that same category, I think, where it's a good card and it's fine, but I feel like there's a lot of things that I kind of would rather play, than Threads.
This goes back for me about, like, trying to predict how good the Ascendancy combo deck's gonna be. I mean, I think you're gonna see a lot of blue-red decks coming out of this, trying to mirror the power of the, like, Legacy deck. So, Swift Spear, Goblin Guide,
Pyromancer,
Delver, stuff like that. And against those decks, that card's insane. Stealing a Pyromancer is one of those feelings that's probably unmatched. Stealing a Pyromancer, kill your Delver, make a token. So, I think the card is very good. The problem is that we see a turn where we wind up in a very combo-heavy metagame. So, if the Ascendancy deck pushes us into a metagame where Ascendancy is like public enemy number one, and people adopt a very aggressive form of affinity
or Jund.
Pod, twin to fight it, I think we're in bad shape. If people are adopting Jund, Junk, Zoo, I think it's great. So I think it's going to be seeing where the format goes here. If we diverge to where this becomes a combo on combo metagame, and Modern has certainly done that at various points in its history. The very first Modern metagame was very combo on combo. If Modern heads in a combo on combo direction, I think the value of Threads heads way down. Because it's not very good against Pod, it's not very good against Splinter Twin, it's not very good against the Ascendancy combo. And it's very mediocre against Affinity, because they often have Ravager to Sack to put counters on things, or Shrapnel Blaster, other ways to kind of move around the threats, where most of the creatures just kind of stink and there's a cranial plating on them. So, it really depends on which way the metagame is going to head. If the metagame heads in a Junk, Jund, Zoo, blue-red Delver direction, then I think Threads is going to be awesome. If it heads taking us into a combo winner, I think that you want to shelve your Threads. Also, I personally put my Threads through a dryer one day and don't own any, and then they got too expensive to replace it. So you won't see me casting that card anytime soon.
And, you know, Threads makes me think of Sower of Temptation. I look at Sower every now and then as a card. Obviously, it's a blowout if it never dies, because it steals stuff and it attacks for two in the air, and I have definitely cast a fair share of Sowers just to kill an opponent with a 2-2 flyer. But Sower's another one of those cards where I think it's going to be more powerful than it is, and it ends up being a bit more fragile than I had hoped.
I mean, Sower is a card I actually do like if we're heading towards a combo winter, just because a lot of those combo decks don't actually carry a lot of removal. I mean, Pod doesn't carry... Pod decks have one way of getting rid of it, if they're, like, Malaira Pod.
Now you can get Murderous Redcap and kill it.
Okay, two. So it's Murderous Redcap, but I was thinking Shriek Maw. So they have, like, two, because the Abrupt Decay doesn't hit it, and Kiki Pod has very little ways of actually dealing with it. So if we head into a Pod, you know, into a Pod Twin metagame, I actually don't hate that card, because I think you'll see a lot less pinpoint removal and a lot more ways of trying to interact with the combos. So I don't hate it as much. I mean, it really is depends on which way this metagame is going to go, and I think which way this metagame is going to go is going to be largely defined by how good Ascendancy is. If Ascendancy is oppressive, then I think we're going to be heading to a lot of combo decks that have good cards against it and, like, a good clock. I mean, Doug has, in my opinion, accurately deduced that Splinter Twin kicks the holy living crap out of the Ascendancy deck. You're just, like, designed to beat it. You play nothing but cards that monkey with the combo, and a combo that's just as fast, or maybe a turn slower, and you can play interaction and they don't.
Yeah, and Izzet Charm scorches that deck.
Izzet Charm scorches it. I mean, I got Twisted Image, I got Bolted, Electrolyze is no picnic when you're in a deck full of 801s. So, I mean, if we're heading to a point where people are going to be playing very fast affinity decks and pod decks that have a lot of hate cards and twin decks, if we're heading in that direction, then I don't actually hate Sower. I think it's still probably a little underwhelming. But I think this is all going to depend on which way this format bends based on where we go with the new set.
Mm-hmm. So I have a kind of two more things on the list, and they're both goofy oddball cards. And I hope they're both retro, and they got our longtime players thinking. And they will surprise you that maybe that both are modern legal. Hypnotic Spectre. It is black one for a flyer, and it can present a horrible random discard for an opponent. You certainly don't have Dark Ritual or even Chrome Mox powering it out. But, you know, you could conceivably play it in Jund or Junk. Black-white tokens. I just don't know that non-targeted discard is what you want in a creature.
I don't think it matches up well enough against any of the cards that exist in the format that you are likely to see. Like, it's not very good against... like Pester Mites and Deceiver Exarchs. It's not very good against Lingering Souls. And
you probably want Tidehall or Sculler over it.
I think Sculler is probably... like, James and I were talking about this last night, actually. I think Tidehall or Sculler, it was a card that saw a lot of play for a while in Modern, has seen various Legacy play. It was pretty good in Standard when it was around. And... yeah, I think the fact that... I think the targeted discard is better. The random discard has the potential to be devastating, but I think the fact that Hypnotic Spectre is just so frail and doesn't match up well enough with a lot of the creatures that you are liable to play against just makes it not good enough.
And there's the idea that you can lock an opponent down with discard and then hit them every turn with that, and they're never going to be able to hold stuff up. But I think if you're able to drench an opponent with a Raven's Crime or something like that, then you probably don't need to worry about locking them out.
I think it's more nostalgic for people than actually good.
I think the last time Hippie saw tournament play was Pro Tour or Kuala Lumpur in 2008, I think was the lower end one. I think it was a 1-of in that deck in Standard.
Now here's possibly a better suggestion for you. Royal Assassin. What do you think about Royal Assassin?
I actually think that Royal Assassin might be really neat going forward. If we wind up with a very combo-heavy metagame, it's certainly an interesting answer to a Splinter Twin deck.
Like, let me tell you what cannot go off with a Royal Assassin on the field. Splinter Twin cannot go off. Jeskai Ascendancy cannot go off. Royal Assassin, also, any deck that plans to kill you by combat cannot get past a Royal Assassin. And I think that there will be, at some point, somebody who conceives of running Junk or Jund with 3 or 4 Royal Assassins main or sideboard, with the idea that if you're playing a mirror match, you're just never, ever getting past a Royal Assassin.
It's certainly an interesting card to consider right now. I mean, it is very weak to Electrolyze, Lightning Bolt, and RPK, and removal, but while it's in play, it's certainly very powerful. And, I mean, that card was very, very good in Limited. It's been good at various points. And I think that we might be heading, if we're heading in a place where a lot of combo decks are, I think we'll probably be scaling back on a lot of the spot removal, and it'll make it probably a little better for that card to sneak in.
It's interesting. Like Hippie, it feels a little slow and frail for the format, but I've never liked the it dies to removal, so don't play it reason for a card, even though I'm invoking it. But it's definitely a powerful effect that is probably not on too many people's radar.
Yeah, so. You know, we certainly play Dark Confidant. That thing dies to everything that Royal Assassin dies to. Dark Confidant's probably a bit better, but Dark Confidant and Royal Assassin present the same sort of problems to a player playing, for example, Splinter Twin. Or even, you know, you're playing a match against an opponent who also has Tarmogoyfs and things like that, and you keep in your Thought Seizes, but maybe you board out your Inquisition of Kozilek, and you want a stronger hitting card. I look at something like Still Moon Cavalier, I look at Royal Assassin. Those are both cards that that actually do stuff. They do stuff, they hold a rampaging opponent back, and
I wonder if Royal Assassin is a card that you could play in pod. Like it doesn't present value to pod in or out of it, but neither do cards like Thrun and Sigarda, and people still have those cards in pod, and certainly playing, instead of having to jam 4 Royal Assassins somewhere, so you have a better chance of drawing them. In pod, you can play 1, and you have a lot of ways of finding it. You have your pods, and you have stuff like Court of Calling. So maybe in something like that, it's good. It seems like it could be a hell of a trump in a pod mirror.
You know, they never get to attack with Linvala. Well, I take that back. Linvala can absolutely shut down a Royal Assassin. I'm sorry. The other great thing about Royal Assassin is that, unlike when I was playing in 1995, Royal Assassin is no longer $8. It's more like 80 cents. So other nostalgic players out there, I hope you remember ogling Royal Assassins in your game store's case and looking up the price on the back of Inquest magazine to see if, on the off chance, your opponent would even trade theirs away, which they wouldn't. Your friends would never get rid of those things. But Royal Assassin can still live. Icy Manipulator is in Modern also, if you want to just totally go down the silly combo route of yesteryear. But I look at a card like that, and I think that when people were playing it in Standard, because it did see some Standard playoff sideboards, it was silly until people started dying to it, and then it became a very, very serious thing to fight against. And I think that Royal Assassin has the potential to be one of those high-impact, permanent-based sideboard cards that we're a big fan of on this podcast. Well, that concludes our list here. If you like this segment, let us know. And if you have cards that you want us to talk about, please let us know as well. We will certainly be bringing back the Is It Good segment. I think we've talked about probably a total of 25 cards between Jeskai Ascendancy and the Is It Good part. So hopefully you're not talked out of listening to Magic Cards, and we want to hear what your favorite cards are, what your unloved tech bullets from the sideboard are, definitely write into us. You can find us on Twitter, or you can find us on the MTGCast website. And until next week, I'm Doug.
I'm Adam.
I'm James.
And this has been The Modern Enthusiast.